Blog Talk Radio.
Mama Africa, Mama Africa, am I coming home, hello Mama Africa, how are you, I'm feeling fine, and I hope you're fine too, hello Mama Africa, how are you, I hope when you hear these words, your grace turn blue, grace turn blue.
Welcome to another edition of Your World News. I'm your host, Solomon Kamajan, and each week we try to bring you the news in a very different, a very non-mainstream, very non-corporate-backed media context and approach to the news. We hit you with hard-hitting analysis through commentary, through news bits and pieces that, quite frankly, you know, have to do with news that is often marginalized and vastly omitted from the mainstream Western media. And I'm going to hit the ground running as we usually do. And it's a huge thrill of mine. It's a huge thrill of the show to have this brother that we have on the show today. And that is none other than Abiyomi Ezekwe. He's joining us from Detroit, Michigan. And he is a phenomenal journalist, phenomenal historian, Pan-African community activist, has done amazing things from coast to coast, not just within Detroit. And so we have him on the show today to put things into a deeper context, because he is a journalist and he covers things from an international perspective. He covers news not just within the borders of the empire known as the United States of America, but also covers things within the Caribbean, throughout the African diaspora, and certainly within the continent of Africa. So I want to welcome Brother Abiyomi to the show. Brother, can you, all the different superlatives and things that you've done, if there's anything that I haven't mentioned in your introduction, can you kind of introduce yourself to our listeners and tell us what you do and why you do the work that you do?
Well, first of all, thank you very much for inviting me on the program. It's an honor to speak to you and your audience. The work that I'm involved in stems out of a search for the truth, to do the type of analysis and the type of commentary that's essential to understand what is going on in today's world. We know that the corporate media plays a key role in the overall oppressive apparatus directed against African people and all oppressed people. Therefore, I think it's essential that journalists attempt to uncover what is true and to, in fact, break away from the many falsehoods that we're subjected to on a daily basis through the European and European American dominated media. So that is what we attempt to do with the Pan-African Newswire.
Thank you so much. And before the end of the show, listeners, we're definitely going to give you information in terms of where you can find his online newswire. It's one of the places I visit on a daily basis. When I get up in the morning, you know, there's a couple places where I search where I visit to find news that is often, you know, very much like you said, not covered by the mainstream Western press, and that is Pan-African Newswire. But I want to hit the ground running. I want to start from the cradle of civilization itself, the continent of Africa, where mankind started, where so many great things that we know, that we, you know, have, I guess, to take for granted today, started. And it seems that, not seems, it's you know, a definite fact that the African continent in very many ways is under attack by external forces, you know, such as Western multinational corporations, Western countries, appendages of Western countries such as the IMF, World Bank, those types of things. And I wanted to ask you, brother, what do you think are some of the most pressing things that are confronting Africa, her people, her soil right now, whether it's Congo, whether it is imperialism, neocolonialism? What are some of the more pressing things that you feel are confronting Africa right now?
Well, all of the ones you mentioned, the fact that Africa is the cradle of humanity, that it produced the world's oldest, most innovative civilizations, cultures, and to see where Africa is today in regard to the dominance of world imperialism over its resources, over its economies, even over its cultural life.
Right.
So we see the major challenge is to recorrect these oppressive conditions, and it can take on many different forms. For example, we have the problem of inequality of trade. There's also the problem of the lack of development, and the reason why Africa is so, quote, underdeveloped, unquote, is because the role of slavery, the role of colonialism over the centuries has served the purpose of exploiting Africa and impoverishing people. This is something that's not inherent to the African condition, but something that has been imposed on African people over the last several centuries. Today, despite the fact that we have over 50 independent states on the African continent, we still are facing some of the same difficulties that we've coming out of the period of the colonial era during the post-World War II time frame. Since 1956, and particularly in Sudan and in Ghana, we've seen the era of African independence that extended from the 1950s all the way up into the 1990s with the independence of Namibia and South Africa. But at the same time, we still have not overcome the economic hardships. It continues today. You mentioned in your introduction about the role of the International Monetary Fund, the World Bank, and other financial institutions and the overall oppressive apparatus against Africa. But I think this whole process is continuing. Now we have greater military involvement on the continent. If we look and see what is happening in Somalia, what's happening off the coast of Somalia, in the Gulf of Aden, and in the Indian Ocean, there is a real military threat, a threat of military encirclement of key areas on the African continent. And that's another major concern that African people should definitely keep an eye on during this current period.
Right. And speaking of Somalia, I read a piece that you wrote some weeks back at the height of, I guess, the height of, you know, media coverage around, you know, the so-called pirates and piracy in Somalia. And I didn't see one, you know, Western, you know, whether it was NBC, MSNBC, ABC, certainly not Fox News, CBS. I didn't see one, you know, one of the mainstream outlets that is, you know, based within the U.S. cover it from the perspective where they actually put in context that, you know, that Western multinational corporations had long been illegally fishing in those waters and in Somalian waters, and also dumping toxic waste that had seeped on shore and was starting to affect the people. Could you put in to deeper context, like what is the real story behind, you know, the so-called Somalian piracy, especially what most Americans have no idea because it wasn't given to them?
Well, we have to go back and look at the history of the post-colonial period in Somalia. After the independence of the country around 1960, we have to understand also that Somalia, the Somali people, were divided up between five different states, former colonial powers, as well as Ethiopia. And we had the involvement of Italian colonialism, British colonialism, and French colonialism, which divided the Somali people. And then, in 1969, there was a military coup in Somalia, which its leadership attempted to change course and move towards a socialist direction that lasted for several years. In fact, even in 1974, that was what was considered the Mogadishu Declaration, which was a very strong anti-imperialist statement that was issued in 1974 by the leadership in Somalia. And then, of course, in Ethiopia in 1974, that same year, we had an upheaval in the country, which brought about the fall of the monarchy of Haile Selassie. And then there was a sharp turn to the left in Ethiopia. So by 1977, the United States military involvement in Ethiopia under the monarchy of Haile Selassie was removed, and there was a sharp turn towards the Soviet Union. Soviet Union came in and provided military assistance to the Ethiopian government at that time under the Derg. And I also want to mention that the Cuban internationalists also intervened in Ethiopia during this same time period as technical assistance as also as military advisors. Then in 1978, we had the intervention of Somali military forces to support the Western Somali Liberation Front, who was trying to fight the Ethiopian control of the Ogaden region. This was in 1977-78. In that time period, the Carter administration, Jimmy Carter, who was president between 1977 and 1981, was coming out of the Vietnam defeat, the defeat of U.S. imperialism in Southeast Asia, and also the defeat of U.S. imperialism in Angola, because the American government at that time, in 1975 and 1976, had backed the South African, racist South African aims and objectives in Southern Africa, and they backed the UNITA and the FNLA synthetic liberation movements in Angola. And then, of course, all of that was in the course of what had happened in Somalia in 1977-78. The Siad Barre regime in Somalia at that time broke its ties with the Soviet Union and opened itself up to an alliance with the United States. Now, in 1978, the Somali government under Siad Barre requested U.S. military assistance in their fight to break away the Ogaden region from Ethiopia and have it form an alliance with Somalia. Well, the U.S., of course, did not intervene militarily, and the Somali regime under Siad Barre suffered a tremendous defeat in 1978 at the hands of the Ethiopian military backed up by the Cuban Internationalist forces. After that time period, there was a lot of economic distress that took place during the late 70s, during the early 80s. There was famine and other types of food deficits in Somalia. Then this increased nationalism inside the country and eventual civil war. So by the early part of 1991, the regime, Western-backed regime of Siad Barre, collapsed. And since that time period, there has not been one fully internationally recognized government in Somalia. Now, the United States intervened in 1992 under George H.W. Bush, the father of George W. Bush, under the notion of Operation Restore Hope. It was really a military invasion in December of 1992. It wasn't projected as that. It was projected as a humanitarian mission. However, by the spring and summer of 1993, there was a full-blown military occupation, and the Somali people were resisting the intervention of the United States and also the United Nations. But the UN, United States intervened under the rubric of the United Nations, but at the same time, there were other countries involved as well, Canada, Italy, Pakistan, and some other states was backing the U.S. objectives in Somalia at that time. So by late 1993, the U.S. had suffered such tremendous defeat. And politically at that time, under the Clinton administration, they were not prepared to engage in a long-term direct military occupation of Somalia. So they withdrew. The U.S. withdrew in 1994. Now, despite that, Somalia was still not able to form a government that was internationally recognized. Then you had two breakaway regions, Puntland and Somaliland, which broke away from the rest of Somalia. So we had three different entities in Somalia that were claiming to be legitimate governmental forces. And, of course, this went on all the way up until the period of 2001, when you had the hysteria surrounding the attacks on September 11th in New York and Washington, D.C. And then at that point, Somalia became another focus under George W. Bush. They began to say that Somalia was a haven for al-Qaeda terrorists or al-Qaeda allied terrorists, so-called terrorists. And then, of course, this went on until the period of 2006, where the United States became quite alarmed when the Union of Islamic Courts had come together and reestablished some type of normalcy inside of Somalia in 2006. But this normalcy that was established under the Union of Islamic Courts was being done independent of the United States. So they attempted to finance certain warlords within Somalia to come in and to destabilize the Union of Islamic Courts. This didn't work in 2006, so later on that year, they encouraged the current regime in Ethiopia, Meles Zenawi, who is heavily financed and assisted militarily by the United States. They intervened in December of 2006, and it created the worst humanitarian crisis on the African continent. I mean, this intervention and occupation was resisted on a widespread basis by the Somali people. And as a result of that, the Ethiopians were forced to pull out, at least formally, in January of this year. But at the same time, the African Union, mission to Somalia, AMISOM, in the meantime, was supposed to set up a peacekeeping force in Somalia to maintain some semblance of normalcy in the country. This was done in order to avoid U.S. or European intervention inside the country. However, this was not able to be carried out because the African Union states, most of them, were not willing to send in troops. So you had troops there from Uganda and Burundi, largely. Those are the two countries that have set up their military forces in Somalia. And there's been reestablishment of a transitional federal government under Sheikh Sharif Ahmed. And Sheikh Ahmed was part of the Union of Islamic Courts. But then, of course, there was a split during the Ethiopian occupation over what the character of the new government was going to be, whether or not the African Union forces should pull out of Somalia, whether they should stay. One faction of the Union of Islamic Courts said that they were willing to work with AMISOM, the African Union forces. And another faction that was headed by Al-Shabaab, which is a youth group, rejected that. And also Awais, who was based in Eritrea, headed a group called the Alliance for the Reliberation of Somalia, also supported the same position as Al-Shabaab, and they formed another alliance called Hizbul Islam. So now what you have is Hizbul Islam and Al-Shabaab, who have taken over large sections of the country, and even the capital of Mogadishu, and they're battling Sheikh Ahmed's government, the transitional federal government, that is actually being backed now by the United States. The United States has supplied over $160 million to the African Union to maintain those military forces in Somalia. So that gives you a general idea of what's happening on the ground in Somalia. But then off the coast, as a result of the destabilization of the Somali state, you had a breakdown of the fishing industry and the shipping industry, which the Somali people could benefit from tremendously. And then at the same time, you had the dumping of toxic waste, of even nuclear waste, off the coast of Somalia near the Gulf of Aden and in the Indian Ocean. So as a result of that, the piracy movement, so-called piracy groups, were established to patrol the areas off the coast of Somalia and also to extract some of the resources that rightfully the Somali people should benefit from. There are billions upon billions of dollars of goods, military goods, oil, and other types of commodities that come through the Gulf of Aden every week. It's one of the major shipping lanes in the world. And also the Indian Ocean, too, is very key to international commerce. So this is why the piracy movement came about. And this has also provided another excuse for the United States and other European countries to intervene. And not just those countries, mind you. China has also sent ships to the Gulf of Aden, as well as other countries, because there's so much involved economically in that region. So what has happened is that the piracy situation has become so critical that the U.S. has sent flotillas of warships to the Gulf of Aden, to the Indian Ocean, along with these other European Union states. And right now there's a major battle over the control of the waters off the coast of Somalia. So that kind of gives you a general framework of how this whole situation developed.
That's right. And so the whole piracy thing is kind of like a farce. It's resistance. A lot of it's resistance. So it's not saying that, you know, all of the so-called pirates are resistance forces, but many of them are. Many of the so-called pirates have been resisting Western forces and have been protecting their own shores, it seems like. Is that what your basic understanding in terms of the whole piracy situation?
Yes, and we also have to understand that not one person had been killed over the last several months through the seizure of these cargo vessels until we had the intervention recently of the United States Navy when the Maersk Alabama, which is a Danish-owned, U.S.-flagged vessel, was involved in that area. It was seized by three Somali pirates, and the standoff that ensued because of the holding of the American captain of that ship. And what's very interesting about that whole episode is that there was negotiations that was going on between the Somalis and the United States Navy. And one of the young men who had been involved in this holding of this captain was wounded, and he actually surrendered to the U.S. Navy, and he's being held right now in New York City. He's 16 years old. He's a minor, and he's going to be tried as an adult under U.S. law, a law that was developed during the period of slavery. Now, I mean, this is totally outrageous that they would bring somebody all the way from Somalia to New York City who's a minor and indict them on charges, that come out of U.S. law, and it came out during the period of slavery. These are slave-era laws that are being implemented against Africans, and we're here in 2009. So right now, the young man is being held in New York City, and he has been charged. He pled not guilty, and there has been an appeal issued on his behalf by a number of groups out on the East Coast, and also the young man's mother, Abdi Musa. His mother has said that she has appealed directly to President Barack Obama to obtain her son's release, that he's a minor, and that he should not be tried as an adult. So these are some of the dynamics that are going on. A few other Somalis have also been captured. Some of them are being held in Kenya. Some other ones are being held and by France. Also, there's efforts to establish a so-called piracy tribunal to set it up in Kenya. Kenya, of course, is another state in East Africa that is heavily supported and influenced by the United States. So this is just a mechanism that the U.S. imperialists are utilizing to intervene in the Horn of Africa to establish military bases there, and also to exploit the resources on land as well as the waterways in that region.
All right, thank you. That was excellent. That was that's exactly what I wish so many folks had an opportunity to know in a deeper context. I mean, I really appreciate that response, because that puts things in such a great context.
Well, you see, yes, let me just add that this is why the corporate media has to be held responsible for the overall militarist phase of U.S. imperialism that we're facing right now. Because if you watch CNN, if you watch the other corporate-controlled media outlets or read their newspapers, you can see very clearly that all the people that they usually get to discuss or to analyze what is going on in Somalia, or even what is going on in Afghanistan or in Iraq, it's always someone who is either in the military, a former a military officer, someone who's involved in the intelligence services, or who is a former CIA or national security intelligence analyst, or they work for think tanks, which are financed by the U.S. military and the intelligence agencies. So if you watch it very closely, the viewpoint that you get is a military viewpoint, and that military viewpoint supports the aims and objectives of U.S. imperialism. So even in Afghanistan and Pakistan, in terms of what's going on right now, what's being presented to the American people is that these military operations are essential to the safety and well-being of the American people. So they frame it in a way in which people have to think for themselves, because otherwise you'll believe that this is necessary, it has to happen. If it doesn't happen, our lives and our way of life will be put in danger by these lawless, quote, terrorists, unquote. And if you talk to most people around the world, they see the United States as being the greatest threat to world peace, more so a threat than al-Qaeda or any other power throughout the world. And this is one reason why I believe Barack Obama is very key. The role that he's playing right now is very key in terms of the U.S.'s image around the world. And maybe we can talk about that a little later.
Yeah, definitely, definitely. Yeah, you're right. I mean, his image is key, and so it's key where it, you know, if it goes the right way, it could be a very positive, positive reversal or change of direction in terms of how the U.S. is viewed around the world. Or if, you know, he's continued to be controlled by his inner circle of advisors and those, you know, the corporate media and those military heads that so many of them control Washington, then it could be much of the same. And, you know, we could continue to see more death and destruction around the world, the same way we're seeing in terms of the people in Afghanistan. Innocent civilians in Afghanistan and Pakistan now are under siege by drone attacks as well as military raids on, civilian, you know, compounds, villages. And that's something that, you know, I had to look outside, you know, and view stations, you know, like you said, you know, the media outside of the U.S., they display the faces and the stories of people who are getting bombed, who are getting bombed to death, and the vast majority of the people that are perishing because of the military strikes that the U.S. is inflicting upon Pakistan and Afghanistan are innocent civilians. And what that does is that continues to foment anti-American sentiment, which is what the CIA, I believe, calls blowback. And so, you know, you're right on. I couldn't agree with you, you know, anymore in terms of, you know, the role, the key role that he can play either positively or negatively.
Most definitely.
Yeah. And moving a little, well, actually, you know, since you brought up the military, I know something that I found that the vast majority of Americans, at least that I've spoken to, have no idea in terms of what's coming down the pike, in terms of how the U.S. is planning, and you know, since I believe it was 2007 of the Bush era, to further militarize the continent of Africa through an apparatus, through a policy, through a program called AFRICOM. If you could explain to folks what AFRICOM is, and what scares me is that we have somebody by the name of Susan Rice, who is, you know, the United States, who was person that Barack Obama appointed to be the U.S. representative to the United Nations. And she's always had a hawkish approach to the continent of Africa, whether it was Zimbabwe, whether it was Somalia. I mean, if it was up to her druthers, I believe that she would love to see a full-scale bombing of Somalia, of, you know, various parts of Eastern Africa. And also the black face that they put on AFRICOM, Kip Ward, General Kip Ward. What is this thing called AFRICOM?
Well, AFRICOM is the United States Africa Command, and they claim that it's designed to consolidate U.S. military operations on the African continent. The African continent has been divided up into various theaters. The northern part of Africa is generally considered part of the European Command, and the area around the Horn of Africa that we had discussed before was considered as part of the Middle East command, and there was the Indian Ocean command. So AFRICOM, at least theoretically, was to consolidate U.S. military policy for the African continent as a whole. They talked about the need to fight terrorism, to curtail al-Qaeda or other, quote, terrorist involvement on the continent, for example, in Somalia or in the Horn of Africa. That was another major concern, stated concern by the U.S. There was so much of an alarm among the African nations, even states, and also the African Union, to the notion about the formation of AFRICOM, that over the last year and a half, they've changed at least their propaganda around what the aims and objectives of the African command should be. They began to talk more in terms of capacity building and assisting African governments with security concerns, not so much about fighting terrorism. However, I was able to interview a couple of weeks ago the United Nations, the African Union ambassador to the United States, Mrs. Amina Salam Ali, who is originally from Tanzania. And even though she's in a diplomatic position, she had to admit that the reason why it caused such great consternation, even among African states, was because of the lack of consultation on the part of the United States with various African states. And she even referred to states that are considered allies of the U.S. And what's very important also for people to understand about AFRICOM is that the United States already has military relationships and military support programs with various African states. I mentioned earlier Uganda and Burundi. Both of these states in the eastern part of Africa are recipients of U.S. military assistance and U.S. military training. Rwanda is another state that has considerable involvement of the United States in its military apparatus. In fact, the president, Paul Kagame, had attended military training here in the United States, and he had been a part of the Ugandan military for many years prior to the formation of the Rwandan Patriotic Front. And there are others. For example, right now in Djibouti, which is in the Horn of Africa, there is a U.S. military presence there, and it is playing a key role in regard to the United States' objectives in the Horn of Africa. So this is a major concern of the African people. In 2007, the Foreign Ministry of Nigeria said that they were opposed to the formation of AFRICOM. Also, the Defense Ministry in South Africa during that same time period was saying that they were in opposition to the involvement. Later on in 2008, they were opposed to U.S. military involvement in Africa and any state that would allow such a thing to occur. So the Africa Command was looking for a state on the African continent to set up a base as a base headquarters for AFRICOM. Now, in 2007 and 2008, they were not able to do that. The West African state of Liberia appeared appeared as if they were interested in allowing the U.S. to set up a full-scale AFRICOM base in Liberia, but at least publicly they've moved away from that. Although historically, the U.S. Military and the U.S. Security and intelligence apparatus have had close ties with Liberia, going all the way back at least to World War II. And they had a huge Voice of America monitoring station there during the so-called Cold War. So it's really not clear in regard to the extent that the United States Africa Command is involved in Liberia. But at the same time, formally at least, the base of AFRICOM is still in Stuttgart, Germany, that they have not been able to move into Africa with the rapidity to which they wanted to. And that has a lot to do with the role of the African Union and also non-governmental organizations, popular organizations on the continent as well. So AFRICOM is definitely a major threat to Africa's sovereignty. And we can see very clearly that U.S. military intervention in the so-called third world has been detrimental, not only to the states, but also to the peoples of all the countries where they have military operations today. Just look at Colombia, for example. Colombia is the third greatest recipient of U.S. Direct U.S. aid, U.S. military assistance. Behind Israel and behind Egypt, you have Colombia. And we can see clearly that the U.S. influence in Colombia has been extremely devastating for the Colombian workers, for the Colombian peasants, for the African Colombian population, because it has caused great displacement. They have one of the largest per capita rate of assassination against trade union leaders, and it has done absolutely nothing to better the overall conditions of the masses of people in Colombia. Let's look at what's going on right now in Pakistan, for example. The U.S.-backed government in Pakistan has been launching military attacks in the Swat Valley against supposed Taliban and al-Qaeda presence in that area. Over 2 million people have been displaced just over the last several weeks. Look at Afghanistan. thousands upon thousands of innocent people are killed in Afghanistan every year. And the economic conditions in Afghanistan have actually worsened since the United States military involvement in that Central Asian nation. We don't have to even talk about Iraq, the devastation that the U.S. invasion and occupation has caused in Iraq. Over 1 million people dead, over 4 million people displaced, millions of others have been turned into refugees, total destruction of the water system, the power system in Iraq, mass unemployment because the U.S. imperialists, when they came in, they terminated the employment of the entire military and civil service and professional class inside of Iraq itself. You have probably no clean water in Iraq, poor economic conditions, and the war there is still raging despite the fact that they try to project it to the American people that the war in Iraq is essentially over, when in fact, just last month, there were more U.S. soldiers killed in Iraq than had been killed over the last 8 to 9 months. So all of these things are going on. So we can see very clearly by looking at other parts of the world that U.S. military involvement always worsens the humanitarian conditions of the people in those particular regions. And that's why, even if it's just instinctively, the African masses and also the African states have opposed the placing of AFRICOM on Africa's soil.
Yeah, that's right. Moving a little bit, I guess, to the west of Somalia, we look at Sudan, look at southern Sudan, we look at Darfur, and we look at the and this is where I really hope if you can put in perspective what's going on in Sudan. A lot of folks don't even know the historical perspective in terms of how colonialism and how British rule in Sudan, you know, played a huge role decades ago when the people in southern Sudan, they fought so hard, you know, they were only awarded, you know, so many parliamentary seats, and that was a premeditated plan by the British to cause friction between the North and the South. And then we look at what is going on today, the external factors that are involved, the so-called, you know, as you said, NGOs and nonprofit organizations that such as Save Darfur, you know, and the disingenuous role that they're playing in not just Sudan, but worldwide, because it's amazing how many people have heard about Darfur through Save Darfur. And, I definitely know that you can put in much deeper perspective the role these types of NGOs have played to further diminish the real humanitarian effort that is going on internally within Sudan, as well as, you know, people that actually really give a damn about the people in Sudan. And the other thing, if you could bring up, is the role that the ICC has played, because the ICC, to me, is a farce, because it seems to only indict African leaders and the role that they played, you know, with al-Bashir in terms of, you know, of putting him on Front Street and causing that friction where there was a reaction within the country in terms of aid relief workers there that you know, he at that time, I guess, he felt that, you know, they were trying to impugn and subvert, you know, his authority. And this was all triggered by, you know, what I like to call external forces. What is the Sudan? What's going on with Sudan? And if you can give a historical perspective so that folks know that this is not something that just happened overnight. This is something that there's a cause and effect to what's going on.
Well, first of all, we have to understand that Sudan is one of the emerging oil-producing states on the African continent. They have been up to producing, the last figures I saw at the end of 2008 was 1 million barrels per day of oil. And the fact of the matter is that the United States over the last decade or so has been barred from exploiting the oil in Sudan. Most of the concessions that have been granted by the government there have been done in collaboration with the People's Republic of China and other Asian states. So you can see right there that would, of course, inherently be a source of conflict as far as the United States is concerned. Here you have Africa's largest geographic nation state, approximately 40 million people who live there, one of the emerging oil-producing states, yet the United States has been alienated from that whole process of oil exploration and exploitation. Then we also have to understand that the economy in Sudan has been growing by leaps and bounds for over the last decade. This is what you don't hear. We see the displacement in Darfur because of the civil conflict that's going on there, but they never talk about the tremendous economic advances that have been made in Sudan over the last decade. A lot of it is related to the oil industry and also its economic partnership with the People's Republic of China. But as you mentioned, when Sudan was under British colonialism, it was a deliberate policy of divide and rule, indirect rule. The country was largely ran as several independent units. And in 1955, on the verge of its national independence, civil war broke out among the people in the South with the people in Khartoum, the capital. And this lasted for 17 years. And there was an agreement in 1972, which ended the war for about 11 years. And then under Jafar Numeri, who just recently died, the war broke out again in 1983 because we had the intervention of Chevron and some of the other oil, Western-based oil magnates that had discovered oil and were setting up a process of oil exploration in the country. The war went on with the South for another nearly two decades, and there was a peace agreement that was put into effect in 2003, and of course, right in the aftermath of the peace agreement between the Sudan People's Liberation Movement and the Khartoum government, we have the eruption of a civil war in the western part of the country in the Darfur region. So this has been going on now for about 5 years, and what we have to understand about Darfur is that Darfur is a part of Sudan. If you listen to the corporate media, you would think that we're talking about two separate countries. Darfur has always been a part of Sudan, and Darfur also has oil, and it's divided up into three different regions, three different states in the western region. And we had the intervention of Israel, and Israel, of course, is heavily financed and politically supported by the United States. But it's come to light just recently that Israel is training one of the key rebel groups in Darfur, and they have been behind the support, along with pro-Israeli groups here in this country, of the so-called Save Darfur campaign. It's not the NAACP, it's not the Urban League, it's not the Rainbow Coalition or the Congressional Black Caucus that's spearheading the Save Darfur campaign. It's the pro-Israeli groups here in the United States that are heavily behind the campaign to win sympathy for Darfur. And this, of course, in projecting the Darfur conflict as a racial war between the so-called Arab-dominated North and the black African so-called tribes of the Darfur region, then you play on the racial sensitivities of people in this country, and therefore you try to build up a case for direct U.S. or United Nations, or I should say U.S. involvement under the guise of the United Nations, and this is what they've been trying to do over the last several years, by making claims that the Sudanese government had a deliberate policy of carrying out genocide in Darfur, and so you have race, you have allegations of genocide, and you have the desire to dominate oil resources in that region, and also the role of political Islam as well, and also the state of Israel. All these factors, all these variables are involved in U.S. foreign policy toward Sudan. Now, under the Obama administration, we had the recent appointment of a U.S. special envoy, who is a retired Major General, Scott Gratian. And Gratian had visited Sudan in early April. And when he went there, he spoke very diplomatically in regard to improving relations between Sudan and the United States. However, if you look over the developments that have been occurring over the last several months, it indicates that even the Obama administration's policies are still designed to undermine the sovereignty of the Sudanese state. For example, the International Criminal Court, which the United States is not even a part of, and has refused to allow its citizens to be subjected to the ICC authority, it seems to be working in conjunction with the ICC to undermine the Sudanese sovereignty. They have indicted several African leaders, as you mentioned, and one of the most recent, of course, is Omar Hassan al-Bashir, the president of Sudan. And the AU, the African Union, and the Arab League both have objected to the ICC indictment of Omar Hassan al-Bashir. But at the same time, the United States, as I said, they're playing a two-pronged they're using a two-pronged strategy. On the one hand, they appointed this special envoy to ostensibly improve relations with Sudan, but then at the same time, every opportunity they have to undermine the status and the sovereignty of Sudan, they will do this. Just one recent example. Reports surfaced earlier this year that Israeli-commanded U.S. made fighter jets and drones bombed at least two convoys in the eastern part of Sudan in January and February. And this resulted in the deaths of dozens of people from several countries in the Horn of Africa. Now, the United States was initially suspected of direct involvement in the bombing. However, subsequent statements that came out indicated that the Israeli Defense Forces executed the operation, and they did it under the guise that they were intercepting arms shipments from the Islamic Republic of Iran through Sudan to Hamas in Gaza, in Palestine, in occupied Palestine. And this is an area where the Palestinian people have been resisting these vicious attacks from Israel. And, of course, we saw what happened in December and January where they essentially carried out a real genocidal policy against the Palestinian people with the support of the U.S. Imperialists. Now, both the United States and the Israeli officials have confirmed that a bombing attack on a convoy of trucks in Sudan did occur. And they were claiming that they were these convoys were carrying arms from Iran to Gaza. And on March 31st, an anti-war website reported that, and I want to quote, it said, today confirmed, it says, Israeli officials today confirmed that dozens of aircraft, fighter bombers, and drones were involved in the January attack against a truck convoy in Sudan, which killed at least 39 people and destroyed dozens of trucks allegedly loaded with weapons, unquote. Then the Sudanese officials said the attacks took place on January the 27th and February the 11th. The government denied that the convoys were involved in arms smuggling. This is the Sudanese government, saying that the vehicles were transporting nationals from various countries in the region. They were being transported to work in Egypt. And so, you know, these things are going on. And then there was a follow-up attack as well. On a ship under the guise of combating arms smuggling from Iran through Sudan into Egypt and over to Gaza to support the Palestinian people. So all of these things are going on, and this is why the Pan-African Newswire has taken a different editorial position than a lot of other publications have taken in regard to the Darfur question. We feel very strongly, based upon our own analysis and research, that the situation in Darfur has to be resolved between the Sudanese government and the people of Darfur themselves with the intervention of the African Union and possibly the United Nations and other independent entities, and that a military solution is not going to resolve that question. We also have to understand in regard to Darfur that there has been a peace agreement signed between the Sudanese government and some of the rebel groups. There are about 12 different identifiable rebel groups in Darfur, so they're very fragmented and splintered. it's not one uniform group in Darfur. There are several organizations that are fighting against the Sudanese government. Some of them have ceased their hostile activities toward the Sudanese government and have even gone over to work with the Sudanese civil defense forces and doing security work in the Darfur region. Also, we have to understand the international dimension as well. Neighboring the Darfur region is Chad, which is a former French colony, which has a French military presence, which is actually bolstering the government in Chad. So these things are going on. Chad is accusing Sudan of attempting to intervene and militarily overthrowing Chad. Chad is accusing Sudan of being involved with the UFR rebels, which recently staged an offensive in Chad. Chad is also a emerging oil-producing region as well. There was a $4 billion pipeline that was built earlier in the decade that has a lot of multinational involvement in Chad as well. So we have the role of French imperialism, U.S. imperialism, which is both are competing with each other for greater influence in Africa, for greater control over the oil resources on the African continent. And at the same time, you have the State of Israel, which feels threatened by the Sudanese government because they believe that Sudan is playing a role in arming the Palestinians who are fighting on a daily basis for survival against the State of Israel. So all of these factors are going on, and we have to look at the Darfur question within this context. And in terms of it being a racial conflict, we reject that as well because we realize that there has been a lot of noise about Arab influence in Sudan. And, of course, in the north, the government there does have close ties with the Arab League. They're members of the Arab League, but they're no more Arabs than other Muslim groups in that country. You know, looking at it from the standpoint of people in this country, when they travel to Sudan, they often ask, well, where are the Arabs, or who are the Arabs? Because the people who they say are Arabs look just like people who they say are Africans.
Exactly.
So, you know, we need to take all these things into consideration when we're looking at the Darfur question.
That's an interesting point that you ended on, is that most Americans, and this is the role, this is the role, the criminal role that the U.S. media has continued to play and mainstream, apparatus of U.S. government, such as the public educational system, have continued to play in terms of confusing so many Americans, because they don't know, most Americans don't know the difference between an Arab and a leprechaun. You know, it's like, you know, they don't understand that Arab, you know, an Arab can be, dark black. It could be, somebody that's brown skinned, that it could be somebody that's white. The distinction is based around, primarily based around a language grouping. And so they don't understand that, an Arab can be Christian, an Arab can be, can be Muslim, Arab can be atheist, they could be, any
even
one of those
Jewish.
Things. Yeah, even Jews, exactly.
I mean, there are Jews in Morocco, in Egypt, and other countries in North Africa. There are, of course, Jews in Ethiopia, and even in Uganda and other parts of Eastern and Southern Africa. There are groups there that claim that they are Jewish and can actually prove they have connection with the Jewish tradition based upon their world outlook and their religious philosophy. So being Muslim, being Jewish, these categories have been racialized, but it's a lot more complex than what's made to appear by the U.S. Corporate media. I also wanted to mention, too, that the International Criminal Court has never indicted the United States or any of these other European countries which have been committing atrocities against people of color for decades, for centuries. For example, what's going on right now in Iraq, the fact that over 1 million people have been killed as a result of the U.S. occupation. We don't hear anything about the International Criminal Court indicting Donald Rumsfeld or George Bush Jr. or Dick Cheney. Now, I'm not giving any excuses or providing excuses for the rebel leaders and the dictators in Africa who have committed atrocities against people. But far greater atrocities have been committed and are still being committed by the U.S. and by these other European countries, and nothing is being said about that. So, you know, it's a double standard that's in operation, and people need to see it for what it is. At a recent NATO summit in Strasbourg, France, which was attended by President Barack Obama, a lot of lip service was paid to the U.S. administration by the European imperialists, who agreed that NATO would send 5,000 more troops to Afghanistan. And they said this, but then when you read the fine print, the Europeans were saying that they would only be there to provide security and provide training. So in Afghanistan, and with the same thing in Iraq, the war is becoming more and more Americanized. It always was, but they were able to get some European countries and countries from other parts of the world to at least make it appear as if they were involved in this to make it look like an international or multinational effort. But now it's becoming more and more Americanized. Same thing with the situation on the Horn of Africa. You know, it's really going to be the United States that's going to supply the shock troops, that's going to supply the funding and the training to dominate these regions. And it's the same thing with Sudan. You look at it very closely. It's the U.S. That is fueling the flame of tension in Darfur, and they're using the State of Israel. And it's also a way of getting at Iran, because if they're charging Iran with supplying military equipment to the Palestinians in Gaza through Sudan, then it also gives Israel a rationale, since they've been wanting to carry out a large-scale aerial bombardment of Iran against their so-called nuclear sites in that military nation. And the U.S. doesn't want to carry that out on its own, because it was a big debate in the Bush administration over whether or not they should bomb Iran. At one point, it appeared as if they were going to, but then they backed away, because even people within the military itself were saying that it would be a devastating policy to engage in large-scale aerial bombardments of Iran. And even one of the key figures, Admiral Thalen, was forced to resign in 2008 because he disagreed with the Bush administration over its Iran policy. He said openly that there would be no bombing of Iran under his watch. And after he said that, he had to leave. So it's also a mechanism, the Sudanese question, it's also a key mechanism for providing a rationale for the bombing and further isolation of the Islamic Republic of Iran, which this year is celebrating the 30th anniversary of its revolution.
Right. There's something I wanted to bring up, and this is, you know, based on, I know that you wrote a piece about this, you know, some weeks ago, and I think you've written actually several pieces on what's going on in, you know, so-called Nigeria, and we know that name and those borders were imposed, you know, upon it by British forces, like most of the borders throughout the continent of Africa. But looking at the movement for the emancipation of the Niger Delta and the resistance, because we see a strain from it for each region that we've talked about, we see strong resistance from people on the ground to fight imperialism, to fight neocolonialism, to fight capitalism at every step of the way. And looking at capitalism and drawing a strong distinction and a strong line, you know, from capitalism through one of its apparatuses, and that's Shell. What is, because a lot of folks, like, and another thing, I mean, the people, you know, the description of men, and oftentimes, you know, whenever it's mentioned, which is not that much, in terms of what's going on in the ground in the Niger River Delta area, they mention MEND as this terrorist organization with no perspective about who MEND is, what MEND, you know, what they're fighting against, what they're trying to protect, and they never, ever, ever, ever mention Shell. And what's interesting, Shell is on. Is on trial right now in New York City, and we'll talk about that a little bit later. But What's your take on men? What's your take on what's going on in Nigeria, in the Niger Delta area?
Well, yeah, just recently the Nigerian government launched an offensive in the Niger Delta against the movement for the emancipation of the Niger Delta. And because they have been carrying out resistance actions, seizing oil installations, kidnapping oil workers, and here again, they have not been murdering these people. They mainly have been doing this to make a point and also to get resources, because the multinational oil companies that are operating in the Niger Delta destroy the environment. They destroy the way of life of the people, and hardly none of the profits that have been accrued from the exploitation of oil for decades in that part of Nigeria have been shared with the people who live in those areas. So they're literally destroying people's lives and at the same time providing absolutely no compensation for the damage they're doing in that area. And just recently, people have been killed. They've been displaced in Bayelsa State and in River State, and it's spreading. The conflict there is spreading. And MEND, which has been carrying out a lot of these operations, are saying that they want some equity in terms of distribution of profits from the exploitation of oil. Now, the problem associated with that, of course, is that the Nigerian government is a capitalist government. It's heavily allied with the U.S. and with the West in general. And it's a very, very difficult situation for the Nigerian government because they get 95% of their foreign exchange reserves from the export of oil. And, of course, oil prices have been fluctuating over the last several months. They have gone back up recently, but they have dropped precipitously beginning in the latter part of 2008, extending over the first half of 2009. So that's placing a strain on the Nigerian government itself. And at the same time, the resistance, not just from men, but there are other groups too who are unarmed that carry out resistance efforts, even if it's just through theft or the damage of oil equipment, or, as I said before, the seizure of oil workers. And these people have not been killed. They've just been held for the transfer of resources. So one of the top leaders, in fact, a man by the name of Ken Wiega, known as Daddy Ken, was executed just a few days ago by the Nigerian military that's operating, the so-called Nigerian Joint Task Force that's operating, carrying out this offensive in the Niger Delta. And he was a part of one of these groups in the Niger Delta that's affiliated with the movement for the emancipation of the Niger Delta. So, yes, the situation in Nigeria is very volatile in the Niger Delta area. And as you mentioned before, there are efforts right now to take the case of the people, the Ogoni people, to the federal courts here in this country. Ken Saro-Wiwa, who was a leader of the Ogoni people, was executed by the former military regime in Nigeria back during the latter part of the 1990s. And that case is being pursued on a civil level here in this country at this time. So these are some of the factors that are shaping the political developments in Nigeria as we speak. But this is another country that's a heavily oil-producing country. It produces more oil that's exported to the United States than any other country on the African continent. I think Angola is second, although there was some debate over whether Angola or Nigeria was the largest exporting country. But the figures that I've seen, most recent figures, indicate that Nigeria is still dominant in terms of the export of oil to the U.S. So, yes, this is very important as far as the United States is concerned. They want to maintain the flow of that oil, the control of that oil, because less and less amount of oil are coming from the Middle East, and more proportionally of African oil is coming into the United States. And this is going to make Africa even more of a focal point for U.S. military, political, and economic intervention.
Right. I wanted to ask you if you could candidly tell us what role do you think capitalism has played in the overall destabilization of the continent of Africa, as well as throughout the diaspora. We see how capitalism reared its ugly head in parts of the Caribbean this past year, in Martinique and Guadeloupe, and how that affected the people. And, you know, you saw like a groundswell of people protesting and quite frankly, fighting back through protests and trying to organize, you know, unions to fight the French government for just the criminal act that it was imposing upon the people, you know, charging them outrageous fees on supplies, you know, that grocery supplies that they weren't even charging, you know, residents and citizens of France itself. And at the same time, Guadeloupe and Martinique were, in terms of the pay that people were getting was paltry. And to ask them to pay, you know, 6-8 times, you know, more than what you're paying, you know, for pasta there than you pay in France was actually criminal. But it seems like the roots of all this stuff that's going on, you know, whether it's in the continent of Africa, throughout, you know, for diaspora, you know, Haiti, Jamaica, what have you, they can all be traced to capitalism. What role, what role do you think capitalism plays in all that, and what's your analysis of capitalism itself, especially in comparison to the big bad, you know, socialism? I mean, I consider myself a socialist. I love socialism, but it's often, you know, in the criminal mainstream media within the U.S., socialism is always displayed as something evil, something heinous, you know. So I know it's kind of a loaded question, but if you could try to tackle it best you can.
Well, yes, the origins of world capitalism, of course, came out of the conflict between largely Western European countries and against the peoples of the East for the control of global trade routes. The world economic system prior to the 15th century was not dominated by Western Europe. There were international trade routes. There was a whole global economic network that had functioned for centuries around the Indian Ocean basin and other geopolitical regions of the world, which largely excluded Western Europe. Now, that began to change during the 15th century. You had the Western European explorers in Portugal and in Spain who went into the western part of Africa and began to develop trade routes, trade relationships, and also slavery. Some of the first slaves from Africa were brought to Western Europe, to Spain, to Portugal. And this was during the early to mid years of the 15th century. And then, of course, during the latter part of the 15th century, this became more of the standard practice of the European monarchies. And then in the 1490s, of course, we had Columbus, who came to the Western Hemisphere. He was an Italian, but he was commissioned by the Spanish monarchies. And that actually set up the conditions for the establishment of the European colonies in the Caribbean and in Latin America and eventually in North America. Now, Eric Williams, who was from Trinidad, he was a historian, said that the profits accrued from the exploitation of African labor during the Atlantic slave trade provided the capital for the industrialization and the origin and the growth of industrial capitalism in England and in other Western European countries and eventually in the United States. And he analyzes this in a book entitled Capitalism and Slavery, which was written as a doctoral dissertation and was published during the 1940s. And, of course, there have been other African writers who have written on these topics as well, C.L.I. James, his book, The Black Jacobin, deals with the role of French imperialism in the rise of world capitalism. Then, of course, W.E.B. Du Bois, in his book, Black Reconstruction in America, that came out prior to Eric Williams' book, Black Capitalism, came out, Black Reconstruction came out in 1935 during the Depression. And he talks about the role of the U.S. and the slave trade and the exploitation of slavery in this country being key in the industrialization of U.S. History. So, you know, slavery has been key in terms of the development of capitalism, and of course, capitalism cannot remain confined to one country, to one geopolitical region. It has to expand, and it then becomes imperialism. And Lenin wrote about that during the early part of the last century, saying that imperialism was the high stage of capitalism. And then during the 1960s, at the height of the national independence struggles in Africa, Kwame Nkrumah wrote a book that was published in 1965 entitled Neocolonialism, and he called it the last stage of imperialism. And I think his position is still correct today, because that's why the U.S. imperialists are so desperate, because they are in their final phase, the neocolonial phase, where prior to this decade, or at least the 1990s, there was somewhat of a reluctance to intervene directly in these geopolitical areas of former colonial states. But now, the neocolonial phase of the struggle has been falling apart. So we have more of a desire to intervene by the U.S. and France and Britain directly in these former colonial territories. And with that happening, that unmasks neocolonialism, and therefore it's a much more difficult struggle for them if they have to intervene directly, because then that mobilizes the people on a national basis, and also it mobilizes the anti-war and anti-imperialist forces in the Western states, and you have a greater opportunity for an alliance between people in the so-called metropolitan countries and people in the developing countries. So, yeah, we're in a position right now where we can't actually see that imperialism is in its last, stage. So, yes, I think that's very important to recognize the origin of the crisis as being in capitalism and capitalism growing into imperialism and, of course, being in this neocolonial phase. This is the root cause of the desperation that we see on the part of the United States. And Barack Obama, for example, his election was historic, but at the same time, forces within the ruling class saw in him the ability of putting a new face on U.S. imperialism.
Right.
So he can go to the University of Cairo today, and he can give a major address on how the U.S. wants to normalize relations with the Middle East, with the Muslim world. But then at the same time, people are still being displaced in the Swat Valley in Pakistan. People are still being killed and occupied in Afghanistan. In Iraq, the war is still going on there, even though the millions of people went out and voted in 2006 and in 2008 to end the war in Iraq, and the war continues. And they're not going to be pulling out this year. In fact, they're sending new forces into Iraq without even telling the American people that this is what is going on. And as you mentioned, Susan Rice, who is his major advisor on foreign affairs and who represents the United States at the United Nations, doesn't have a clue in terms of what is required in this current phase of history in regard to the role of direct military involvement, direct military intervention by the United States in Africa. It can only lead to disaster. Then, of course, we have people like Hillary Clinton, who is the Secretary of State. And when she went to South Korea several months ago, engaging in saber rattling and increased tensions in the Korean Peninsula, we had the recent testing of a nuclear device by the Democratic People's Republic of Korea and the launching of several missiles, and they just announced yesterday that they're going to test a long-range missile. Now the U.S. imperialists really don't know what to do. because they have a front in Pakistan and Afghanistan and Iraq. They're involved in Somalia. They're trying to manage the situation in Sudan. They're trying to come up with a solution to the crisis in Palestine. In Latin America, it's moving more to the left. The U.S. Economy is in deep crisis, the deepest crisis since the Great Depression. And now they're faced with another possible war on the Korean Peninsula. So, yes, I believe, you know, as in, you know, 40-plus years ago, that, yes, neocolonialism is the last stage of imperialism. And Barack Obama, even though he has, to a certain degree, ameliorated the hostility people towards U.S. imperialism, I don't think that's sustainable. And unless there's some fundamental changes made, and I don't think there can be any fundamental changes made because the imperialist system will not allow these changes to be made because it's essential to its functioning and to its well-being and its continuity. So we're going to still see militarism. We're still going to see the super exploitation of labor. And we're still going to see these contradictory policy imperatives, whether it be in Sudan or Afghanistan or in the Middle East or on the African continent, and also right here in this country, because Obama was also elected with a mandate to re-correct the economic crisis in this country. And he's not going to be able to do that either, because the type of measures that are required, the people who are backing him, who are advising him, are not going to allow him, or at least they're not going to advise him, to engage in a large-scale social spending that's going to be necessary to rehabilitate, at least make an attempt, an honest attempt to rehabilitate the U.S. economy. For example, the military budget is over $700 billion annually. Now, that's not sustainable. I mean, you can't justify spending over $700 billion a year on the military when you're not getting the results you want in Afghanistan and Pakistan and Iraq and these other geopolitical regions that we've been talking about. And if you're not getting the results, that means that $700 billion every year is a total waste. It's taking away from resources that could be allocated to rebuild the cities, to rebuild the farming industry in this country, to provide quality education, to provide national health insurance, to fight racism and national discrimination, women's oppression here in this country. So this is completely a contradiction. On the one hand, you have Obama representing an historic accomplishment, having the first African-American elected to the presidency in the United States, something that many people thought would never happen. But at the same time, unless there's a fundamental change in the composition of the U.S. government, the social forces that constitute the political will and the political structures of the United States social system, if that doesn't change, then the system as it stands now, in my own humble opinion, cannot rehabilitate, cannot reform itself, and it's going to continue on this downward spiral until there's a real coalescing of social forces in this country in conjunction with forces in Africa, Asia, Latin America, the Caribbean, and so forth, to bring about a real political and economic revolution in the West and throughout the entire planet. That's what's got to happen. There's got to be a total break with capitalism, a total break with imperialism, and that's the only way that we're going to have a real economic renaissance, not only in this country, but throughout the world.
All right, and that's a brilliant solutions-oriented point that you brought up, and that's why it's so important. I keep telling folks that, you know, even for those folks that voted for Obama, I voted for Cynthia McKinney, but even for those folks that are Obama supporters, it's vastly important if they're not heard from, if there's not a strong groundswell from the folks that supported him the most, then they can expect to see much of the same, and much of the same is what's going on right now. And you mentioned, you know, the economic resources that this country has doled out to these you know, these criminal corporate institutions. They could be used to rebuild cities such as the city where you reside in, you know, Detroit,
exactly.
Michigan. As well as other cities, and we have a couple minutes left, and you know, when we speak about Detroit, because Detroit has the highest unemployment rate in the entire country. It's been under attack for a long time, experiencing different, you know, aspects of gentrification. But one of the things that is going on in Detroit, that's going on in many other cities that have large populations of people of African descent, is the attack on black people by the Gestapo-style police, police institution. And I know recently you had Robert Mitchell, who was a 16-year-old brother, a minor, who was tased to death by the Detroit police. And then there was a recent police shooting that involved, you know, three brothers, where the cops, I believe, walked onto the porch at a Detroit a city home and ended up, you know, fatally killing one of them. Can you talk, you know, for like, you know, a couple minutes? We have about 4 minutes left. You can talk about, you know, a couple minutes on what's going on in Detroit, you know, regarding all those things.
Well, Detroit is important for at least two reasons. One, the role of labor in Michigan is very key in terms of the development of the eight-hour day and the recognition of the United Auto Workers and other trade union organizations during the 1930s and 40s. And, of course, the national question or the racial question, the role of black people, you know, in the working class and in the overall labor force was also very important. So you had this merging of race and class in the city of Detroit. And then the history of that, which we don't have time to go into, was key in terms of the desire of the capitalist class to outsource, to deindustrialize. And we saw Detroit, once considered the so-called arsenal of democracy, becoming the classic economic tragedy, because you had massive job losses. And when that goes on, you're going to have an increase in the repressive apparatus of the state. And we see that happening right now. More and more police killings, the desire to criminalize the African-American population, particularly the youth, and the tasing death of Robert Mitchell, 16-year-old African-American youth, who had been stopped in a neighboring, just right across the border, Warren, which has a reputation of being a racist community. The police, Warren police, chased him over into Detroit, which is just a few blocks, and chased him into an abandoned house that had been foreclosed. The home was wide open. He was apprehended, but they still tased him, and after he was tased, he died later on that day. There's been protests surrounding that. His family has a civil suit that's been filed, a wrongful death claim that's been filed in federal court. Then, of course, the shooting that took place on May 20th, where three African-American youth were shot by the police on the west side, and it's amazing that no one was killed in that conflict either. And there's just protests that's been going on around that. And these protest actions, although they've been supported by the Detroit Coalition Against Police Brutality and other groups, these actions have largely been organized by people in the neighborhood themselves, which is taking the struggle to a whole different level. Because when you start having grassroots people in their communities organizing against repression and other forms of injustice, then that means that we have the possibility of moving this struggle on to a whole nother level where it really can become a mass struggle. And that's what's needed right now. So, yes, the economic crisis is going to breed more and more law enforcement repression. And we see that not just in Detroit, but in Oakland, California, with the death of Oscar Grant, and in New Orleans, and other parts of the country, where, you know, largely black youth, Latino youth, are being shot down by the police almost on a daily basis. And people have to organize against that because this is done to increase fear and also to create a situation where the black community and the other oppressed community can be criminalized, and therefore they can justify sending in police, which are becoming more and more militarized.
Right. Thank you. And on that note, I want to leave the door open. I hope that, because there's so many other things that I wanted to discuss that we didn't get a chance to get to, but I want to leave the door open. Hopefully you'll come on again in the near future and dialogue with myself and our listeners. But for our listeners who want to find out more about Pan-African Newswire and the work that you do and maybe even get in contact with you, I know you're a national renowned public speaker. How can they get in contact with you in terms of your website or what have you?
Well, they can log on to our blog. It's at panafricannews.blogspot.com. That's panafricannews.blogspot.com. And they can also email us through the website. And the website is updated every day. It covers news throughout the African continent, throughout the Pan-African world, and throughout the international community as a whole. It also has a sidebar with links to most of the African news agencies and websites, as well as other important aspects of the struggle of African people as it has evolved over the last several decades and several centuries. So, yes, please log on to the Pan-African Newswire site. That's at panafricannews.blogspot.com. And, yes, we would definitely be interested in coming back again on your show.
Thank you very much, Brother Abiyomi. And I just want to thank you so much for the insight that you've not just provided on this show for me and the listeners, but also, since I discovered, a friend sent me the link to your website. Since I discovered your website through the gift that a friend gave me by just sending me the link, I've been able to gain, a lot deeper insight and get, a grasp on a lot of the news that I haven't been able to find on any mainstream site. And so I just want to thank you so much, and I hope, the viewer, please make sure you go to panafricannewswire.blogspot.com. It's a must-read on a daily basis. You're going to get analysis, and you're going to get news that you will not find on the criminal mainstream corporate-backed media. I promise you that. So thank you so much, Brother Abiyomi.
Thank you for having us, and also thanks for your contributions to the Pan-African Newswire as well.
Thank you. Take care, brother, and for everyone else that's listening, look forward to seeing you on the next episode of Your World News. Bless you.
This song probably been done about a million times, but it ain't never been done like mine. We're talking about a million Africans. We're talking about 10 million Africans. We're talking about 100 million Africans.
The African Holocaust,
we're talking about the genocide that went down in Rwanda. We're talking about Darfur. We're talking about Sierra Leone. We're talking about a million diamonds. We're talking about the Congo, B. We're talking about a million of our people in prison. We're talking about a million of our people dead, unemployed, homeless, hungry, B. 1 million Africans. 10 million Africans, 100 million
Y'all
Africans.
Tripping. 1 million Africans, 2 million Africans, 10 million Africans, 100 million Africans.
They say we ain't got no right to complain. I just laugh at them. You can have the whips and the chains. I don't hate on them, but hopefully they gonna catch up. I ain't gonna wait on them. Kanye, Lupe, Pharrell, I will skate on them. 1 million black men locked up in prison.
Hold it down.
Think I'm kidding what it is, but I isn't. And if you didn't know, it's just cause you ignorant. Cause pigs lock up motherfuckers just cause of they pigment. That is racial profiling. No, I'm not wildin'. Y'all shuckin' diving.
Yeah, it's about
smiling. 1 million people was here before they even came. And ever since they came, they just changed the game. They brought a few million more and then they changed our names. That Turner, Devil, Burner, come to burn your shit to flame.
We gon' burn it
1
down,
million
baby.
Africans, 2 million Africans, 10 million Africans, 100 million Africans.
1 million Taino, 1 million Arawak, 10 million more of our people who ain't coming back. 10 million of our people with scars on their back.
Cracker, tell me that it don't matter, but matter of fact, I'm the surprise in the box, I will crack a jack. After that ain't nothing else to do but to holler black.
1 million kids who ain't got no options, either they down with the goons or the goblins.
1 million Africans, 2 million Africans, 10 million Africans, 100 million Africans. Drop them off here and now you is the Haitian. Drop you off here and now you is Jamaican. 1 million, 10 million, let's bring it back, man. Yes, they are the devil. What's the devil to a
black man?
Nathan, nothing. They ain't saying nothing. We don't need another old white man.
finger on the button, cause the last white man had that type of power, had 6 million people taking gasoline showers. The Bible told me this world is ours. The meek shall inherit, but that's only to be cowards. One stupid white man can knock down 2 towers. Y'all niggas got it backwards. Y'all niggas got it backwards. 1 million Africans, 2 million Africans, 10 million Africans, 100 million Africans. 1 million Wampanoag, 1 million Blackfeet, 1 million Navajo, 1 million Apache, 1 million Iroquois, 1 million Sioux. You done killed about 1 billion people, maybe even 2. Would take a nation of millions, hold us back, I thought you knew. And everywhere they go, this is just how they do. Was 11 million Africans living around Soweto. 1 million white folks had them in the ghetto. The ghetto, the ghetto. You all love the ghetto. You talk about it so much, but we ain't seen no bread though. Breaking more. I take 1 million, 2 million, 3 million, 4. Build a couple hundred schools, hit you for 4 million more. 1 million Haitians, refugees know the score, cause you don't want 1 million motherfuckers at your door, man. I am Farrakhan and 1 million man marching. Approach me with caution, 1 million people watching. I do this so often, 1 million places on this earth, but I come from Boston. 1 million Africans, 2 million Africans, 10 million Africans, 100 million Africans. 1 million Africans, 3 million Africans, 10 million Africans, 100 million Africans. Harriet Tubman came too. We got a long legacy, this is how we do it. Uno the prophet, Nat Turner, devil burner. 1 million Africans, 10 million Africans, 100 million Africans passed through that transatlantic slave trade, the African Holocaust. Don't forget. A million,